Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and today I'm talking to Sergey Khan, a professor of anthropology and Native American studies at Dartmouth College. He's writing a book about the Creole population, a section of society who are mixed descent, both Russian and Alaska Native. The Russians and the Alaska Natives are living together, and a lot of the relationship is indentured servitude, but they are living together, and because of this, there becomes a whole Creole culture of a mixed descent relationships. The people who were in these relationships, were they outcasts? Were they just become? Did they just become part of the culture?
No, they definitely were not outcasts. And this is actually a very good question. And I'm currently doing research, particularly on the population was called Creole. They borrowed that term from the Spanish. People of mixed descent. So I'm looking at Sitka in Southeast Alaska, Creoles after the transfer. So I'm actually looking at people of mixed descent who had Russian blood after Russians left. But, of course, this kind of mixing began much earlier, probably as early as, 18th century when the Russians began marrying Native women or living with them. The obvious issue, and the same exact same issue, was happening in Canada. You have single men coming, colonizing, but very few Russian women. So obviously you have a relationship between indigenous Native women, Alaska Native ladies, and Russians. And the offsprings are these people of mixed descent. And gradually, this mixed population is quite significant. It outnumbers the Russian population of Alaska. And this is very important to keep in mind, that the Russian population, I'm talking Russian immigrant population, immigrants from Russia, people who came from Russia, it never was very large. It never exceeded, I can't remember the exact figures, but it was less than 1,000 people.
Wow.
Maybe less than 800 people at the maximum, and even lower, okay? So by the time Alaska was transferred to the Americans, the Creoles outnumbered Russians by significant numbers. So the biggest Creole group was Aleut Russian and also Aleutic Russian, people of Kodiak and the surrounding region. And what happened is, yes, there was some prejudice. This idea that some Russian historians are promoting that Russians were so enlightened and so tolerant, unlike Americans who were, racist, I think that's a bit of a stretch. But, a lot of these Russian men were former peasants and sailors, and they themselves were of the lower class. And they also lived side by side with Native people in Siberia, in the Russian north. So they were used to dealing with and even marrying or cohabitating, if you wish, with Natives, indigenous people in the Russian Empire. So I think they were not particularly condescending towards their Native spouses, and they took care of their Native children. So the situation is somewhat reminiscent of the so-called Métis population of Canada, particularly French Cree, French Ojibwa. So these Creole children, and then they grew up, and they also married often, these Creole men married Native women, or they often married Creole women. So you have a whole Creole class. And because they were offsprings of Native Russian American company employees, the company educated them, okay? So by the time these young men, and to some degree women too, but mostly men, by the time they got some basic education, at least, the reading, writing, arithmetic, they were already a better educated group of people than probably even some of their Russian fathers, and certainly native hunters who were employed by the company, okay? So gradually, the Russian-American company began using these Creoles in a more demanding, a little more sophisticated, higher-level positions within the company employment hierarchy. So, and the Creoles themselves began to see their own group as being somewhat higher than the natives. So, for example, they didn't want to do hunting. They preferred to work as clerks, as some of them became priests, or at least lower-level church deacons. So they knew something about the Orthodox theology and creed and rituals. They worked on company ships, but maybe not as sailors, but like somewhat higher positions. A few of them reached a pretty high level. One of them, from a very famous Creole family of Cachaveros, he lived in St. Petersburg and wrote for St. Petersburg magazine. So that's unusual. But there were a lot of educated Creoles. Father Nitsveto, very famous missionary, he buried in Sitka, was a Creole. So Russians created this class and gave it important jobs. They relied on them because they had to. Their own population of Russians was so small, and the Creole population was growing. They had this very convenient, useful group to rely on. And in fact, eventually they created a kind of social category of Creoles, which had their own rights and privileges, like a separate estate.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and I'm talking to Sergei Khan about the Creole population, and I asked him what effect the Creole population had on Alaska Native culture.
On the one hand, a lot of the Creoles still had, I think, kinship ties with the Native community. One other occupation, I think a very important one in a multi-ethnic, multicultural world of Russian Alaska that I didn't mention is interpreting. So a lot of the interpreters, translators for Russian American Company were Creoles. In Sitka, for example, Tlingit interpreters were often offspring of Russian men and Tlingit ladies. But they had relatives like this interpreter, the one I've written about, Ivan Zhukov. His mother was Tlingit, and he had relatives in the village in Sitka. So he wasn't completely cut off from the native community. And, of course, the Tlingit being matrilineal, they traced their lineage through the mother, they still treated him as part of the clan, the family. So I wouldn't say they were completely cut off. On the other hand, I think you have a point that partly because of the Russian indoctrination and partly because they had a higher status in the company hierarchy, some Creoles definitely began to look down on the native people, on the full-bloods, if you wish. We know, for example, that particularly on Kodiak, they actually had separate villages, Creole villages and Aleutic villages. And Creole villages looked more like Russian villages. And this continued all the way into the 1900s. So like 30, 40 years after Russians left, there were still distinct separate communities, and American visitors commented on that. So in some ways, there were differences. And what's really interesting, and this is what I'm doing my research right now on, is in Sitka, most of the Creoles, after the Russians left in 1867, most of the Creoles stayed behind. They didn't want to go to Russia. Creoles in Sitka were not Tlingit Russian Creoles. They were Aleut and Aleutic Creoles. So they did not identify, with a few exceptions, they did not identify with the Sitka Tlingit community too much and really kept their own identity. So what you have, and this has not been written about, kind of ignored, but you have, at least until World War One, and even World War II, for some families, you had, Sitka was a tri-ethnic community. Anglo or Euro-American, if you wish, white people, quote unquote, Tlingit community, and then this in-between community of people of mixed descent. Some of them, under the American rule, of course, wanted to pass as white because there was a lot of racism. But a lot of people knew who they were. They had Russian names. They belonged to St. Michael's Cathedral. And some of their descendants are still around. And nowadays, you know, people are proud of their Russian heritage. So it's a very interesting group of about maybe 500 people. But for Sitka in the early 20th century, that was a big group.
What's been the biggest surprise so far when doing your research?
I'm not 100% surprised. I sort of expected, because I've read a lot about American attitudes to people of mixed descent and race. And the concept of race really comes to the fore in America in the late 19th century, early 20th century. The really amazing thing is when you look at the census records, every 10 years, United States did census. And in Sitka, it starts in 1880, 1890. The same families and the same individuals from the Creole community, they would be listed as white in one census. 10 years later, they may be listed as Indian, sometimes as mixed. And one census, it's just hilarious because they're listed as Native, and then somebody went back, crossed out Native or Indian, and wrote Russian. So for this gentleman who did the census, Russian was a racial category, which is hilarious, you know. So what this means, or this suggests at least, that American census takers, Anglo-American, Euro-American, they had such a hard time with these families, they didn't know where to place them, and that unlike the Russians who, as I've been telling you today, created this social category of Creoles, the Americans really didn't know how to handle people of mixed blood. Until the 1960s or even later, 80s, when Americans became much more open about their ethnic background and more proud of their ethnic heritages, people in Sitka were really nervous about admitting that they had Native blood. I mean, there was quite a bit of Anglo-American kind of racism. So people, I've been told that, you know, the family knew that grandma was part Aleut, but they never talked about it. Do you see what I mean? So now it's people are much more open, and so you can still learn some things. And so I'm more optimistic that I could still do the work, even though there's no class of Creole. They're just individual descendants here and there, and a number of them no longer live in Sitka. They may be in Lower 48, but sort of traces of that community still exist. That's what I'd like to say.
You've been listening to Sesquicentennial Stories with Sergey Khan. Sesquicentennial Stories is a project of the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCAW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.